I just got one from Phil Mills. Everyone know Phil Mills? He goes, tell everyone there I said hi. I said I would. I wanted to pass these clipboards out. I don't know. I'll start them both directions here, I guess. Name and email, and there's a couple of checkboxes there. If you have interest to be on a mailing list, I promise I won't flood your inbox every day with some sale or something. You know, no, just an occasional update if I have a new DVD series or something like that. And also, I know some of you may be from different churches, so there's a little check there if you want a seminar at your church. I travel and do this every week. I have openings later this fall if you're interested in doing something, if you're not from this church and you want to do something at your church. But either way, at least we can stay in touch via email if you want to put that down. So let's begin with this. Schooled or educated? Schooled or educated? Do you think there's a difference in schooling and education? I think so. Schooled or educated. There were some friends of our family. They run a successful business operation, and they needed somebody for a like an office manager. So they found somebody that had a degree in bookkeeping. And so she seemed, you know, like a pretty good fit for the job. So she started, and unfortunately she didn't stay long. She, my friend that runs the business told me that she seemed sort of incapable of like basic everyday tasks. She seemed, you know, she was good at what she was schooled in, but she couldn't really branch out beyond just this specific schooling. So, for example, one day my boss, or my friend, her boss, asked her to do this simple little accounting task. And she told him, well, I'm sorry, I wasn't trained for that. You'll need to get a CPA to do that. He said it was a very simple task. He did it himself. So it was, you know, a lack of being able to go beyond just what her specific schooling was in. Another friend of mine who is a businessman, he graduated with a 4-year degree in business from a prestigious university, and didn't know how to balance his checkbook. He said he actually thought that if he still had checks in his checkbook, he could keep writing checks. He learned the hard way that that wasn't true. But this guy had a business degree, a 4-year business degree. He should have known better. It was a complete, you know, he concluded his story. He told me this whole story about how he actually learned business was in real life. And he concluded his story by telling me, you know, I was schooled, but I never got educated. And I thought, wow, you know, that's a true statement. How many of us are being schooled, or how many of us are putting our children through what we call a good education when in reality it's sort of just schooling? You know, we need to think about the differences there. In fact, a recent study found that balancing a checkbook, comprehending newspaper articles, and calculating the cost of gas are just a few tasks that many college seniors cannot handle. According to the American Institutes for Research, data revealed that over 75% of 2-year college students and 50% of 4-year college students are incapable of completing everyday tasks. More than 80% of employers said recent graduates were deficient in applied skills like communication, work ethic, and critical thinking. And 72% said they were deficient in basic writing skills. Schooled or educated? What's the difference? You know, it's pretty important that we understand this. In the book Mind, Character, and Personality, we read, now, as never before, we need to understand the true science of education. If we fail to understand this, we shall never have a place in the kingdom of God. Wow. The true science of education. If we don't understand that, we won't have a place in the kingdom of God. That sort of tells me that education is more than just algebra. It's more than just grammar. You know, there must be a spiritual element involved here. Because I really don't think God's going to, you get to heaven and God says, how'd you do on algebra 2? That's not one of the entrance requirements, is it? There's more to education than just the schooling aspect. Now, before I get into this, I want to make a huge disclaimer here that I'm not anti-schools. I get accused of this sometimes. I am very much for good Christian schools. We need good Christian schools. But there's a lot of changes that need to take place. We need to reform in how we are educating our children. But I'm not anti-schools. I think sometimes, though, it's necessary for us to take a step back and look at the problems Look at what is wrong. So while I may come across, I hope I don't come across as critical, it could sound that way, but I promise you, I'm just trying to present to us what the problems are so that we can fix them. Because if we don't recognize the problem, we will not be able to fix it. Point number one, real education develops good thinking skills. That's sort of our groundwork. You would probably guess that I might have this as a point. We need good thinking skills. And a real education will encourage that exploration and encourage good thinking in addition just to the collection of facts that we often see in the classroom today. Just for laughs, George Bernard Shaw says that few people think more than two or three times a year. I have made an international reputation for myself by thinking once or twice a week. thinking can get you places in life. So in addition, though, to just developing good thinking skills, education, good education, true education, needs to teach independent thinking, not just conformity. You see, good thinking skills refer to one's ability to make good decisions, to reason from cause to effect, to apply knowledge in a broad range of situations. But independent thinking is more specific than that. It's the ability to formulate one's own thoughts independent of others' input or opinions. Not that we can't use others' opinions or thoughts, but we have the ability to stand for ourselves and think independently. And that should be a fundamental part of true education, because that is crucial for spiritual strength. The last days will require independent thinkers. We need to know what we believe and be able to stand for it. We can't just go with the flow, because the last days will just pressure us to go with the flow. Romans 12:2 tells us, "Be not conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God." You know, it's saying not to be conformed. Be transformed by the word of God, but don't just conform to the world. It's going to require independent thought. John Taylor Gatto in his book, Dumbing Us Down. Now, that one is anti-schools. I'm not wholeheartedly recommending this book, but he has some good ideas in there. Whatever an education is, it should not make you a unique individual. I'm sorry, it should make you a unique individual, not a conformist. Point number three, education values the unique capabilities and strengths of each individual. Too often this is neglected in common educational methodology. How many of you have more than one child? All right. So how many of you in the morning, one of your kids comes into the kitchen and you're like, "Now which one are you?" Doesn't happen, does it? You might call them by the wrong name sometimes, but you really aren't getting confused between the kids, right? Why? Well, they're different, right? God made them that way. God made them very different. If your kids are anything normal, they're going to be as different as siblings. And that's a good thing. God has made them all unique. And if this is true, how can we put kids through a program that dictates, you know, precisely what they learn and how they learn it if every child is different? God is a lover of diversity. He's made us all unique. There's a very interesting story, a bit of a funny story along these lines, illustrated by this picture. I'll read you the story in a minute. We'll just take this picture in for a minute. For a fair selection, everybody has to take the same exam. Please climb that tree. Once upon a time, the animals decided that they must do something to meet the problems of a new world. So they organized a school. They adopted an activity curriculum consisting of running, climbing, swimming, and flying. Four activities. To make it easier to administer the curriculum, all the animals took all the subjects. They were all highly motivated and wanted to get good grades, so they each tried very hard. Now, the duck was excellent in swimming and flying. In fact, better than his instructor. But he lagged behind his classmates in running and climbing, so he had to stay after school and also drop swimming in order to practice these two subjects. Soon his webbed feet were badly worn from running that he was only average in swimming, but average was acceptable in school, so nobody worried about that except the duck. At the start of the year, the squirrel was first in his class in climbing and running and was second only to the duck at flying, but he developed serious frustration issues in the flying class because his teacher made him start from the ground up instead of the treetop down. He developed Charlie horses from overexertion and caught pneumonia in swimming class, so he missed so much school that he got a C in climbing and a D in running. To make matters worse, because the squirrel constantly squirmed and chattered in class and had difficulty paying attention, he was diagnosed with a learning disorder. The squirrel eventually was placed in remedial classes and had to be medicated in order to continue with his schoolwork. The rabbit started at the top of his class in running, but had a nervous breakdown because of so much makeup work in swimming. The fox was a natural in his running class and scored well in climbing and swimming, but became so frustrated at his inability to get good grades in flying that he began assaulting his classmates. He even tried to eat the duck. His behavior was so disruptive he was expelled from school, he fell in with a rough crowd, and eventually wound up in a center for animal delinquents. The eagle was a problem child and was disciplined severely. In the climbing class, he beat all the others to the top of the tree, but he insisted on using his own way to get there. The elephant, meanwhile, developed low self-esteem because he couldn't do well in any of the subjects. When he sank into clinical depression, his therapist persuaded him to try a different school that focused on subjects such as lifting and carrying. The elephant was disappointed because careers in lifting and carrying were not as prestigious as careers in flying and swimming and climbing or running. Even though he always felt inferior, he managed to make a decent living and to support his family. At the end of the year, an abnormal eel that could swim exceedingly well and also run, climb, and fly a little had the highest average and was valedictorian. The prairie dog stayed out of school and fought the tax levy because the administration would not add digging and burrowing to the curriculum. They apprenticed their children to a badger and later joined the groundhogs and gophers to start a successful private school. Now, we laugh at the ridiculousness of the story, but can you see the parallels? Can you see this in the educational system today and how foolish it is to take a group of children who are so very diverse as God has created them to be and say, no, everybody has to take the same exam. Please climb that tree. It just doesn't work that way. Some people say Albert Einstein said this. Nobody really knows, but it's a great quote. Everybody is a genius, but if you judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree, it will live its whole life believing that it is stupid. Very true. So a good education, a true education, needs to give children opportunities to develop the unique character that God has given them. Point number four, real education needs to allow and encourage creativity. Children are naturally creative. Unfortunately, though, we often sort of educate it out of them. You know, we school it out of them. We school them out of their creative capacities. Sir Ken Robinson, a world-renowned educational advisor, look him up on TED Talks if you want. He's got some great talks out there. But he says, we don't grow into creativity, we grow out of it. Or rather, we get educated out of it. One of the ways we do this is by sort of stigmatizing mistakes. He continues that we are now running education programs where mistakes are the worst thing you can make. We are educating people out of their creative capacities. The freedom to make mistakes provides the best environment for creativity. Let the child and youth be taught that every mistake, every fault, every difficulty conquered becomes a stepping stone to better and higher things. It is through such experiences that all who have ever made life worth the living have achieved success. We squash creativity by sort of dictating the process in which children learn. You know, there's nothing wrong with saying that children need to learn certain things, but we need to be open to allowing them different ways of learning those things. I'll leave it at that. There's some changes lately in the educational system that are not encouraging to this. There was a study done on creativity. Now, you realize it's nearly impossible to test creativity, but they came up with 8 tests on what they call divergent thinking, thinking outside the box. And this was their best test that they could come up with for testing creativity. 8 tests on divergent thinking. And at age 3 to 5, children were scoring, 98% of them were scoring creative genius. Creative genius. 98% of the children. 5 years later, they tested the same group of children. Anyone want to guess what percentage was creative genius now after 5 years of schooling? 50? Good guess. It's 32%, though. Only 32% were now scoring creative genius. Another 5 years, they test the same group of kids. This is a longitudinal study, meaning it's the same group throughout the study. 10 years later, 10%. 10 years of schooling, only 10% of them were scoring creative genius. And adults over 25 were only 2% creative genius. That's a pretty significant drop there. We went from 2% not being creative genius to only 2% being creative genius throughout that schooling process. There's a great little story that illustrates this. It's about a little boy that went to school. Now, I don't want to offend any teachers here because I realize that not all teachers are like this story. But it's a good illustration nonetheless. I think you'll be able to recognize the process of how this little boy's creativity was damaged. So once a little boy went to school, he was quite a little boy and it was quite a big school. One morning when the little boy had been in school a while, the teacher said, "Today we are going to make a picture." "Well, good," thought the little boy. He'd like to make all kinds, and lions and tigers and chickens and cows and trains and boats. He took out his box of crayons. He began to draw. But the teacher said, "Wait, it's not time to begin." And she waited until everyone looked ready. "Now," said the teacher, "we are going to make flowers." "Good," thought the little boy. He liked to make beautiful ones with his pink and orange and blue crayons. But the teacher said, "Wait, and I will show you how." And it was red with a green stem. Red with a green stem. "There," said the teacher, "now you may begin." The little boy looked at his teacher's flower and then at his own flower. He liked his flower better than the teacher's, but he did not say this. He just turned his paper over and made a flower like the teacher's. It was red with a green stem. On another day, when the little boy had gone to school, the teacher said, "Today we are going to make something with clay." "Well, good," thought the little boy. He liked to make things with clay. He could make all kinds of things, snakes and snowmen and elephants and mice and cars and trucks. He began to pinch and pull his ball of clay, but the teacher said, "Wait, it's not time to begin." She waited until everyone looked ready. "Now," said the teacher, "we are going to make a dish." "Good," thought the little boy. He liked to make dishes. He could make all shapes and sizes. But the teacher said, "Wait, I will show you how." And she showed everyone how to make one deep dish. "There," said the teacher, "now you may begin." The little boy looked at his teacher's dish, then he looked at his own. He liked his better than the teacher's, but he did not say this. He just rolled his clay into a big ball again and made a dish like the teacher's. It was a deep dish. And pretty soon the little boy learned to wait and to watch and to make things just like the teacher. And pretty soon he didn't make things of his own anymore. Then it happened that the little boy and his family moved to another house in another city, and the little boy had to go to another school. And the very first day he was there, the teacher said, "Today we are going to make a picture." "Good," thought the little boy, and he waited for the teacher to tell him what to do. But the teacher didn't say anything. She just walked around the room. When she came to the little boy, she asked, "Don't you want to make a picture?" "Yes," said the little boy. "What are we going to make?" "I don't know until you make it," said the teacher. "How shall I make it?" asked the little boy. "Why, any way you like," said the teacher. "And any color?" "Any color," said the teacher. "If everyone made the same picture and used the same colors, how would I know who made what and which was which?" "I don't know," said the little boy. And he began to make a red flower with a green stem. Albert Einstein said, "It's a miracle that curiosity survives a formal education." Again, I realize that's not the case. This story doesn't represent every classroom. But can you see the progression there? You know, when we mandate, you know, we dictate exactly how they're going to learn everything, pretty soon they stop trying to invent ways to learn. They stop trying, you know, we've killed that creativity. So we need to encourage creativity. Point number 5, education, real education, good education includes physical activity. Are you seeing a trend here? I talked about it this morning, I talked about it in the last session, and here it is again. Physical activity is absolutely critical for proper learning. Higher fit children showed greater bilateral hippocampal volumes and superior relational memory task performance compared to lower fit children. Physical activity has been shown to improve overall mental health and quality of life, to enhance brain function and cognition, to improve behavior, improve concentration, increase blood and oxygen flow to the brain, to increase levels of norepinephrine and endorphins, resulting in a reduction of stress and improvement of mood, to increase growth factors that help to create new nerve cells and support synaptic plasticity. Exercise provides an unparalleled stimulus, creating an environment in which the brain is ready, willing, and able to learn. Physical activity is so important. It's just all over the research. The more I look into it, the more important I realize that it is. Both mental and spiritual vigor are in a great degree dependent upon physical strength and activity. Whatever promotes physical health promotes the development of a strong mind and a well-balanced character. Now, we place a pretty high value on character. And here we see that it is dependent upon a strong mind, a strong body. Physical health promotes the development of a well-balanced character. Students should not be permitted to take so many studies that they will have no time for physical training. The health cannot be preserved unless some portion of each day is given to muscular exertion in the open air. Stated hours should be devoted to manual labor of some kind. I don't have this in here. I have it in another session. It's on the DVDs, but I'll mention it real quickly here. When it comes to physical activity, there's not much that can top gardening. And I know you guys are getting ready to do a gardening program out here, and that is amazing. I'm glad you're having David Obermiller here. He's a friend of mine. Keep up that good work. Gardening is powerful. They have found a bacteria in the soil. It's called Mycobacterium vaccae that is absorbed into the skin and actually underneath the fingernails. And yes, you can eat it. Eating a little bit of dirt is kind of good for you. Think vegetables out of the garden. You're getting a little bit of Mycobacterium vaccae there. But this bacterium actually has been shown to improve mood and behavior. They're actually using it to treat depression patients because it's so powerful. There's an article titled, "Is Dirt the New Prozac?" It's such a powerful drug, almost, the bacteria you find in the dirt. It's also shown to improve cognitive function, greatly helps the mind. It helps the immune system. Very powerful immune booster. This just getting your hands in the dirt, very helpful to the immune system. They've actually found that children who grow up on farms have half the incidence of asthma and allergies than children who spend most of their time indoors. Now, isn't that ironic? Because we associate allergies and asthma with being outside, but the body actually has an immune response that when you grow up in that environment and you get a lot of these, you know, allergen and asthma causing things, the body actually kicks in, and there are elements in that dirt that your body is getting that creates the immune response so that you don't have the allergies and asthma. So spending time outside, gardening is absolutely phenomenal for children. I'll mention it real quick here while I'm thinking of it. There's a new book out called Hope in the Soil. This is a compilation of the writings of the Spirit of Prophecy on gardening and agriculture. This is brand new. A friend of mine just released this a few months ago. So I have a few copies of that if you're interested. Great to at least add to your collection for reference. It's very well organized, topical on, you know, it's benefits for children and benefits for schools and other topics. Very well laid out. Okay, moving on from physical activity, education needs to apply what is learned. You know, you hear this argument from kids actually a lot. They say, "When will I ever need this?" Anyone heard that before? I know there's some teachers here that have heard that. You know, they almost have a point, because I think we need to connect in their minds why they need the information. That I'm not discounting the benefit of the information that they're learning, but they need to be taught. They need to have a purpose for learning. Real education should be the acquisition of knowledge for a purpose. Schooling often gives students information, but fails to give them a reason to use that information, fails to give them real-life application for that information. Jesus was the greatest teacher that ever lived, and we're told that Christ imparted only that knowledge which could be utilized. Only that knowledge which could be utilized. It's not well to crowd the mind with studies that require intense application but are not brought to use in practical life. Such education will be a loss to the student. It's not enough even to have knowledge. We must have the ability to use the knowledge aright. It's the use they make of knowledge that determines the value of education. There's a great example of this from the history of Oberlin College. Has anyone studied the history of Oberlin College? Somewhat obscure now, and many people don't think about it very much, but It was very well known in the mid-1800s. It was founded in 1833, and unfortunately it's gone the way of the world now, but in its early years, it was a bulwark of true education. They really did things radically different. They weren't afraid to be different, and they produced some amazing results. They produced an entire generation. Well, let me ask you, what was the major issue on people's minds for the history buff here? What was the major issue on people's minds during the late 1800s, mid to late 1800s? Slavery, you got it. Slavery. Slavery was the major issue on people's minds. That was the whole Civil War issue, you know, that was just a major problem. Well, Oberlin College took an anti-slavery stance, and they said, how can we make our students develop this anti-slavery stance? And so they decided to integrate it into all of their classwork. If I can find the page here, this is from the book Studies in Christian Education. Anyone read this book? Powerful book. You don't want to go home without this book. You will not be able to put it down once you start reading it. It goes through the history of education throughout the early church and the failure and some successes of true education. Okay, so Oberlin College, it says the secret of success of Oberlin College in arousing the students to take the stand on slavery and put themselves where they became leaders in a practical movement to arouse the minds of the people to the terrible wickedness of slavery as an institution, lay in the fact that Oberlin did not conduct her classwork and her lectures along the regular stereotype lines of the schools about them. On the contrary, Oberlin, on every occasion, correlated this subject with the daily work in the classroom. So this whole issue of slavery, it's somehow related to everything they were studying in the classroom. One of Oberlin's enemies understood the secret at the time and wrote, "With arithmetic is taught the computation of the number of slaves and their value per head. With geography, the territorial lines in those localities of slave territory supposed to be favorable to emancipation. With history, the chronicles of the peculiar institution. With ethics and philosophy, the higher law and resistance to federal enactments. Hence, the graduates of Oberlin are masters of art in abolitionism. And with the acquirement of their degrees, are prepared to go a degree or two further if occasion requires. They imagine they are doing God's service." Isn't that pretty neat? They associated everything within the classwork to relate to this issue of slavery. And when those students graduated, they were wholehearted abolitionists. Can you imagine now if we applied this in our schools to the work of finishing the gospel? Everything we did, math class, history class, social studies, whatever it was, somehow related to the finishing of the work of God on this earth. One generation it could happen. Oh, gives me chills thinking about that. Compare this, though. I want to compare this to the papal system of education. Very interesting here. Again, from Studies in Christian Education, this book, the papal system of education makes students content to repeat set, sorry, makes, it's talking of teachers, that them as teachers, makes them content to repeat set lessons to their students as they themselves learned them in school, with no thought of making practical application. The students, in turn, go out and teach the others the same route they have learned, same rote they have learned, and thus the endless treadmill goes on, ever learning, but never getting anywhere. Do we want to be ever learning, ever progressing, ever getting somewhere? Or do we just want to be on the educational treadmill of ever learning but never progressing toward heaven, our final goal? Okay, moving quickly. I have a lot more points here. Real education prepares the student for real life. You know, a real education will train one for real life necessities. We're talking about how to do taxes. You know, they don't teach you how to do your taxes in school. Isn't that funny? And so I finished my schooling, and I'm like, I start a business, and I've got to figure out how to do my taxes. And you're like, why didn't I learn that in school? You know, basic stuff that we should be teaching our students, how to run a household, how to succeed in business, how to communicate well, how to make a positive contribution to society, how to raise a family. I'm not saying that academic subjects aren't important. They definitely are. But we need to think about what is really important for our students to have. My notes out of order here. This is an amazing quote here from the Ministry of Healing. What do students carry with them when they leave school? Where are they going? What are they to do? Have they the knowledge that will enable them to teach others? Have they been educated to be true fathers and mothers? Can they stand at the head of the family as wise instructors? The only education worthy of the name is that which leads young men and young women to be Christ-like, which fits them to bear life's responsibilities, fits them to stand at the head of families. That's a good education. Point number 8, real education encourages students to pursue their unique interests. Thankfully, we've seen an improvement in this in education today in allowing students to branch out, but I don't think it's quite where it needs to be. We need to recognize that it is educational to be exploring in unique interest. I mean, that can be a part of the education. We're talking, you know, shadowing a doctor, going to work with a farmer, going to work, you know, with a woodworking friend, you know, whatever it is, just for some examples. Practical learning is very educational, and so we can, I think we need to include that, you know, that system of apprenticeship that used to be very, very successful. It had its problems, I know, but that was a good idea, and I think we could learn from that. Again, from John Taylor Gatto, it's absurd. It's anti-life to be part of a system that compels you to listen to a stranger reading poetry when you want to learn to construct buildings, or to sit with a stranger discussing the construction of buildings when you want to learn to read poetry. So we need to value those unique interests. Point number 9, education happens all the time through everyday life. I think too often we divide things up in learning segments, like you learn now and now you're not learning. But learning happens all the time. There's no such thing as extracurricular. All of life, every minute of every day counts as learning time, and there are no separate times set aside for education. Even in seeking a preparation for God's service, many are turned aside by wrong methods of education. Life is too generally regarded as made up of distinct periods, the period of learning and the period of doing, of preparation and achievement. So I think we need to realize that education happens all the time. It's not just that you go to school and you're getting ready to do your real life. You can learn through real life too. Children learn what they live. I like that. Point number 10, just moving quickly through some of these. This is all on the DVDs. If you feel like I'm going too fast through any of it, it's all on my DVD series. Point number 10, real education is broad. Schooling is often very limited. True education means more than taking a certain course of study. It's broad. It includes the harmonious development of all the physical powers and the mental faculties. It teaches the love and fear of God and a preparation for the faithful discharge of life's duties. Our ideas of education take too narrow and too low a range. True education has to do with the whole being, with the whole period of existence possible to man. Point number 11. Education is integrated. Schooling is often compartmentalized. In true education, all the parts need to relate to the whole. But unfortunately, we tend to chop it up in the minds of students, and we're not really encouraging connection. John Taylor Gatto here, I don't have the quote, sorry, I have it on my notes, I'll read it to you. The first lesson I teach, he says, is confusion. Everything I teach is out of context. I teach the unrelating of everything. I teach disconnections. I teach too much. The orbiting of planets, the law of large numbers, slavery, adjectives, architectural drawing, dance, gymnasium, choral singing, assemblies, surprise guests, fire drills, computer languages, parent nights, staff development days, pull-out programs, standardized tests, age segregation like anything seen in the outside world. What do any of these things have to do with each other? Good question that he asked there. You know, we need to be connecting things in the minds of our students because real life is connected. There was a story of a college professor, and he taught two consecutive writing classes. He would have one in the fall and one in the spring. And he said that whenever students came back in the spring, they couldn't seem to remember anything they learned in the fall. And it was frustrating him to no end. And so one day a student was in doing some counseling with him and going over some work she was doing in the spring semester. And he said, "Why aren't you applying any of the stuff I taught you last fall?" And she looked at him with this puzzled look on her face and said, "You mean that stuff applies now too?" Totally serious. It was failing to get a connection in her mind, and I think we can't entirely blame the student there, because when they've been brought up in that system of total disconnect, then pretty soon that becomes a mentality and a way of thinking. And so they've lost the ability to connect learning together. But think of the real world. Think of the great natural sequences, like learning to walk, learning to talk, the progression of light from sunrise to sunset, the ancient procedures of a farmer, a smithy, or a shoemaker, or the preparation of a Thanksgiving feast. All of the parts are in perfect harmony with each other, each action justifying itself and illuminating the past and future. School sequences aren't like that, not inside a single class and not among the total menu, of daily classes. Human beings seek meaning, not disconnected facts, and when we place children in that disconnected environment, children soon learn to accept confusion as their destiny, and they stop trying to make meaning out of education. Point number 12, because of most of the things I've just mentioned, education can actually cultivate an interest instead of what we usually see as total disinterest for school, for academic learning in general. Schooling often creates indifference. Again, from John Taylor Gatto, he said, "I teach indifference. I teach children not to care too much about anything because when the bell rings, I insist they drop whatever it is we've been doing and proceed quickly to the next workstation. They must turn on and off like a light switch. Students never have a complete experience except on the installment plan." Okay, real education is learning by doing, even if it's putting toothpaste on the wrong end of the toothbrush. I love that picture. Learning by doing is sometimes discounted in educational environments today. We sort of learn about doing things instead of learning by doing things. And I think we need to bring that back into the educational system. It was Ralph Waldo Emerson that says, "Skill to do comes of doing." Education does not only come from books. An education derived chiefly from books leads to superficial thinking. Practical work encourages close observation and independent thought. Ooh, here's a big one. Real education encourages cooperation, not competition. Cooperation, not competition. We destroy the love of learning in children, which is so strong when they are small, by encouraging and compelling them to work for petty and contemptible rewards, gold stars, or papers marked 100 and tacked to the wall, or A's on report cards, or honor rolls, or dean's list, or Phi Beta Kappa keys, in short, for the ignoble satisfaction of feeling that they are better than someone else. Notice the two factors involved here. One is the environment based solely on extrinsic motivation, which is not the best motivator. Intrinsic motivation is much better than extrinsic motivation, because a child that's motivated extrinsically will soon cease to be motivated at all. There are a couple of great books written on this by Alfie Kohn. One of them is called Punished by Rewards. I haven't finished reading it because he's a really tough guy to read. He writes very complicated. He definitely writes like he has his PhD. But still a very good point. Punished by rewards. His point to the whole thing is that we're limiting children's abilities by making everything dependent upon a reward. You know, everything is dependent upon a reward. But the second factor here is that of competition. The environment of competition. A school environment that is based on grades and rewards and extrinsic motivators is competitive by nature. That's just the way it is. You can't really get around that because if you get a reward, somebody else didn't. And that's just the fundamental part of this environment. And that's unhealthy for learning. It's unhealthy for emotional well-being. It's unhealthy for spirituality. Dan Greenberg of the Sudbury Valley School says that the primary, almost exclusive motive relationship fostered by schools among children in the same class is competition. Cutthroat competition. The pecking order is the all in all. Who is better than whom? Who's smaller, smarter, faster, taller, handsomer? And of course, who is worse, stupider, slower, shorter, or uglier? The children I teach are cruel to each other. They lack compassion for misfortune. They laugh at weakness. They have contempt for people whose need for help shows too plainly. And unfortunately, I've seen this for myself. In the best private schools, among children who you would think are just little angels, give them the right opportunity, and they're not. we can't blame them too much, though. You know, it's that environment where it's all competitive. You're always somebody's better than somebody else. But in God's plan, there's no place for selfish rivalry. Those who measure themselves by themselves and compare themselves among themselves are not wise. But how widely different is much of the education now given. From a child's earliest years, it is an appeal to emulation and rivalry. It fosters selfishness, the root of all evil. So I think that I would make two points here, that we need to, first of all, replace honors and grading with genuine accomplishment. Has the task been accomplished? Has it been learned? That there should be motivation by accomplishment rather than by reward. So everybody can do that. There's no competition involved there. Horace Mann, he was an educational, very instrumental in developing a lot of the educational programs back around the turn of the century. He had some false ideas, but he had some very good ones also. He says, "I hold and have always held it too unchristian to place two children in relation to each other that if one wins, the other must lose. So placed, what scholars gain in intellect, yes, and a thousand times more, they lose in virtue." So it's not that they're not learning. We're not questioning that this system can help motivate learning, but they're losing in virtue. It's a Jesuit educational mantra that nothing will be held more honorable than to outstrip a fellow student, and nothing more dishonorable than to be outstripped. Prizes will be distributed to the best pupils with the greatest possible solemnity. Look at where that is coming from. Very solemn to think about that. That's not a system that we want to be emulating. I also believe that we need to replace competitive sports with useful work. Praise the Lord, you're getting a garden out here. Those students in your school can go work in the garden now, and that is useful work. That is non-competitive work there. You can replace competitive sports with useful work, and that will teach. It's often argued that competitive sports are necessary to develop certain characteristics, or, you know, learning life skills through competitive sports. Yes, you can learn some life skills through competitive sports, but there are detriments to that. There are bad things that you're learning through that process, but you can learn all those same skills through real useful work without the negative consequences of competitive sports. So you can learn all the same things with useful work. Point number 16, education is age integrated, not age segregated. I've already discussed this, but I'll just mention a few points. Age integration allows younger children to engage collaboratively in activities they could not do with just their age mates. It promotes non-competitive creative forms of play that are ideal for acquiring new skills. It allows those who are ahead of or behind their age mates in certain realms to find others who are at their level. It permits younger children to be inspired by the activities of older ones, and vice versa. It allows younger children to receive help and advice without giving up their own autonomy. It allows older children to learn through teaching. It allows younger children to practice caring for younger ones and develop a sense of responsibility and maturity, of empathy and compassion. And it teaches children to relate to those of different age groups in a meaningful way, an essential ingredient for real life. When we segregate children by age in schools and in other settings, we deprive them of all this. We rob them of the opportunity to use fully their natural and joyful ways of learning from one another. Point number 17, education should have full family and community involvement. Unfortunately, the modern school system weighs children down with homework and endless projects, making it impossible for them to find time to learn from their parents and community members outside of school. This denies children what they need to become whole people that can function as productive members of their own community and of society as a whole. 18, education trains good social skills. Research shows that your child's ultimate success in life will depend more on personal characteristics like motivation, creativity, and the ability to communicate effectively with other people than on academics. True socialization is being able to communicate with persons of any age and ability. Conventional schooling hinders this by grouping children only with those of their own age and ability. Point number 19, education sets spiritual training and character development as its ultimate goal. We have to realize that this is the ultimate goal of education. No education is complete without proper character development. It's just not education if it doesn't develop the character. The great object to be secured should be the proper development of character, that the individual may be fitted rightly to discharge the duties of the present life and to enter at last upon the future immortal life. Any effort that exalts intellectual culture above moral training is misdirected. Number 20, education works with a natural schedule of development. We've already seen that in the previous session, that we need to be working with that schedule of development, and that is a part of true education. Lastly, education never stops. Schooling stops. But I'm sorry to tell you, you will never be graduated in the school of Christ. I'm sure the college students here are not too happy to hear that. But true education never stops. Our minds, unlike our bodies, can continue growing as long as we live. In the school of Christ, students are never graduated. Albert Einstein said that education is what remains after one has forgotten what one has learned in school. I'm not sure I entirely agree with that, but a very good point. Schooled or educated? Schooled or educated? If I can get my notes organized, here we go. I'm going to bring out 3 points here. First of all, that you may be saying to yourself, well, I'm a parent, I'm not a teacher. You know, what does this have to do with me? What does this whole education talk have to do with me? I came to a parenting seminar. In his wisdom, the Lord has decreed that the family shall be the greatest of all educational agencies. We need to recognize that the family is the fundamental educational unit. God designed that from the very, very beginning in the Garden of Eden. He continued it into the days of the patriarchs, when the family was the basic unit of education. The schools of the prophets were brought in not to replace the family, but to help the family in their work, to help supply where the family was lacking, because they weren't doing their job. But the family is the greatest of all educational agencies. So you, as a parent, really have... You're a teacher. You're a teacher. Whether you're homeschooling or not, you're a teacher. Even if your kids are in school, you're a teacher because you are the basic educational unit. So take advantage of that. Apply all these points that we've looked at into the educational program of your home. Now, 3 points I want to make about education. First of all, that the work of education and the work of redemption are one and the same. True education is the harmonious development of the physical, the mental, and the spiritual powers. And true education prepares the student for the joy of service in this world and for the higher joy of wider service in the world to come. So, first of all, true education and redemption are synonymous. They're restoring the image of God in the soul. If you see an educational program that does not have this as its goal, that is not restoring the image of God in children, that is not working for the redemption of the students, then it cannot be true education, because this is the fundamental building block of education, the foundation. Point number 2, that true education is the harmonious development of the physical, the mental, and the spiritual. What area, which of these 3 areas is the primary focus of conventional education today? Mental, exactly. We're not focusing on all 3 areas. Sometimes we throw in a sprinkling of the physical and the spiritual, but we need a full harmonious development of all 3 of these areas. And thirdly, education is preparation for service here and throughout eternity. We need to be training our children to devote their lives to service. That is how we're going to finish the work of God on this earth. That is a life of service. God isn't calling us to... His work is not one that provides 6-figure salaries. You know, that's a life of service if we want to be serving Him and finishing the work that He has given us. Jesus followed the divine plan of education. Where did He get His education from? It was gained directly from heaven-appointed sources, from useful work, from the study of the Scriptures, and of nature, from the experiences of life, God's lesson books. So I'm going to close with a story of Martin Luther. Martin Luther, and who knows who was Martin Luther's companion? in the Reformation. Melanchthon, yes. Wow, you're history scholars. Did you know that they started an educational program? They started a school. Luther and Melanchthon did, because they recognized that the value, the power to change their generation, to change the society, lay in educating the children. Their plans were, their success would be limited if they only focused on the parents. So they started a school. Luther and Melanchthon, the great 16th century reformers, understood clearly that it was impossible to have a permanent religious reform without Christian education. So they not only gave attention to the doctrines of the papacy, but also developed a strong system of Christian schools. I did not realize that until reading this book, that they were not just out there teaching their doctrines. They actually developed a school system. Melanchthon said, "To neglect the young in our schools is just like taking the spring out of the year. They indeed take away the spring from the year who permit the schools to decline, because religion cannot be maintained without them." Melanchthon steadily directed his efforts to the advancement of education and the building up of good Christian schools. He declared, "The cause of true education is the cause of God." Wow. The true cause of true education is the cause of God. So in 1528, he drew up a school plan. It was, I won't get into all the details of it. One thing that I thought was interesting, he said, "The teacher should not burden the children with too many books." Even back then, in 1528, he knew that too many books were a problem. But here's the amazing statistic, that these reformers realized that the strength of the papal church lay in its educational system. They struck a crushing blow at this system, and wounding it brought the papal church to her knees. The reformers established a system of Christian schools that made Protestants of the children. This wonderful revolution in education and religion was accomplished in one generation, in the brief space of one man's life. One generation, they changed. Read the Great Controversy. Read the history of the Reformation. You will realize that in one generation, they totally changed the religious outlook of Germany, which is the nation in which they were based. All through the working on the children, a reform in Christian education. Again, I'll refer to what I said earlier. Can you imagine if we put this kind of effort into a Christian education now, be it in the family, be it in our Christian schools, to focus on preparing our children, preparing our young people to finish the work on this earth? We could do it in one generation. And that's an exciting thought to think of. We need that. We need one generation that can finish the work on this earth. It's going to take a radical change. We can't just go with status quo. We have to just throw out the old ideas and just go with the new program. Just step out in faith and do what God has called us to do in educating our children. When is our next meeting supposed to be? Was it about 45 minutes?
Next meeting, do we have a mic here? Thank you. Our next meeting begins at 5:15. We'll go to around 6 o'clock, and we will have a light supper, probably around 6:15. And the sun sets around 6:15, actually, so maybe we can even wrap up our meeting at 6:15 and then just go right for supper.
Sure.
So that when you leave this room, you will be able to look at the CDs or DVDs, the material that he has. If you're sticking around for the supper and for the Q&As, you can. The table will be out there after that as well.
Sure.
So, you know, I want to say that this might be a good time for some of us to go into the kitchen area. I would just make sure that things are ready for the supper. Otherwise, we're going to have a very light supper. And the rest of you go outside and get rid of that myopia degradation.
There you go.
But focus into the distance, not on the person next to you.
Right.
Okay, thank you.